Believing in the future. How can any reasonable, learned, thoughtful person not living in deep denial believe in the future? There is so much anger, so much hatred, so much blood being shed. The blood runs high and it pours out all over the world. How can somebody who is not living in the deepest of denial affirm any kind of sense of hope when you look at reality, the terrible reality of some of our best minds, of science being used to build weapons of destruction instead of being channeled towards healing? When you look at the enmities of race, of religion, of ethnicity, of nation state, how is it possible not to be overcome? When we look at past ages that were hopeful, the ironies have to ring inside of us as we sing songs as we did this morning. The hymn that we just sang, "These Things Shall Be," a loftier race, not meaning race in our normal sense of it, but humanity than ere the world has known before. Flames of freedom. These are wonderful thoughts written in just in the last quarter of the 19th century. Nation with nation, land with land, unarmed shall live as comrades free. The pulse of one humanity. Their optimism had to be shattered. High friendship, hitherto a sin, or by great poets, half divine. They were still fighting issues, and they had optimism that they wouldn't have to be talking about gay rights 130 years ago. Music filling the skies, they're the same issues, century after century, the same humanity. So how do we look at humanity and history and still manage to say yes, to get up in the morning with some sense of hope, some sense of engaging a world and making a real difference in it? It is sometimes, when you pay attention, very, very difficult. But periods of such optimism get shattered and changed to pessimism, and so do periods of deep pessimism and despair. They, too, end in the cycles of history. And there is hope. It's a tough hope. It's, you know, I wanted to make a joke with Bill in terms of sugarcoating our communion soft drinks, but I think we salt it. We salt it because we understand that there are times and moments of some bitterness. We look at our world, and we see the weapons of mass destruction. We see the wars. And it is very difficult not to feel at times overwhelmed and overcome by our seeming inability to learn. Just in yesterday's newspaper, there were so many examples of the hardy perennial of anti-Semitism. Lieberman was giving a speech to an Arab-American group, and he was roundly booed and hissed on his policy statements, about which I have no problem. There are issues that we get to yell and boo and hiss at each other about. But the comment was, he's such a Jew, that's out of bounds. That's out of bounds, along with the Prime Minister of Malaysia saying that all that Jews are interested in is money and that they make Christians and Muslims bear the price and fight proxy wars. And to show you that it's just not there, and with simple-minded anti-Semitism, the other branch of anti-Semitism, of anti-Islam, is General Boykin, the newly appointed head of Defense Intelligence, who has repeatedly been telling Christian groups, I'm picking this up so I get the words exactly right, President George Bush was chosen by God to lead the global fight against Satan. He told one gathering, "Why is this man in the White House? The majority of Americans did not vote for him." That's an interesting admission. "He is in the White House because God put him there for a time such as this." Now, this has a two startling theological consequences to it. Once, it puts God in elections, and the other is that it makes the new incarnation of divinity, not Jesus Christ, but Scalia. And I think that real fundamentalist Christians ought to be very upset by this kind of Christology. This is the general who's leading the hunt for Osama and Saddam, and he said publicly, "The Christian God is bigger than Allah, who is a false idol." Look, Muslims, fundamentalists, also call America the great Satan, Israel the little Satan. Jews are not immune from this kind of stupidity and words and epithets that demean and debase other human beings and other religions and other ethnicities. Human beings do this, and perhaps ironically and certainly perversely, the proof of our common humanity is sometimes manifest by our common inhumanity. We all, not pointing individual fingers at individuals here, but we all of every group oversimplify and condemn and demonize and satanize and make it far too simple by just labeling people without thought as to their individuality and their humanity, and in the process we often lose our own. We have, in addition to all the kinds of racism and ethnocentrism, we have xenophobia. We have xenophobia that we have this fear of strangers. We want to build borders. We want to build walls. We want to build fences to keep them out. And, of course, nobody knows this better than Californians, where foreigners come in here and take the good jobs from real Americans, like governor, leaving our California native, Cruz Bustamante, out in left field. This is the ridiculousness of xenophobia. Nation states were born out of the chaos of tribe and cult and religion coming together in a forced mating that gave rise to nation states. Nation states are coming apart. We hoped, almost everyone hoped, that at the end of the Cold War, there would be a time of real peace, a time of real change. We would have a new enlightenment. But what the world seems at times to be experiencing is almost a re-entry into the Dark Ages, into a time that we see nation states in death throes, that original mating coming apart in new chaos of tribalism, of ethnicities, of religious and cultural conflicts of civilizations. That is what seems sometimes to be happening. But I think there's something else, something more important and really more hopeful. Borders and nation states are becoming less important. It's futile to put up borders. It's futile to try to keep people from where the work is, where the food is, and from the information. Our world has been transformed in good ways as well as bad ways by technology. It used to be that the dictators and the monsters of that old 20th century, if there was news they needed to prevent, stop the presses, burn the presses, arrest the journalists, kill them, restrict the mimeograph machines, unplug the Xerox machines. But now, dictators have fatal alternative choices. They can join the 21st century, or they can maintain their control of information, because information is the product of the 21st century. And a nation cannot be both modern and disconnected from the rest of the world. So you can stop the presses, but you can't stop the net. You can stop the presses, but you can't stop the connections. And of course, like everything else, there is more junk out there than there is information. There is more gossip than there is illumination. But the information and the connections are vital, and they will ultimately connect the world into one world. Ethnicity is doomed. Race is a doomed concept. Maybe not back in the 19th century when they first sang of it, but the world is too small for us not to marry each other and have children with each other and blur those artificial ethnic lines that have always been blurred. That's the history of humanity, but they will be erased. We'll still find ways to hate our neighbor, but it won't be race. That's a doomed concept. There's so much hope as well as fear being offered by our technology. Our world is changing so rapidly, in many ways to the better, in some ways in very frightening forms. The weapons of mass destruction are real, they are mass, and they are destructive. The United States, in my view, does not help the conversation by talking about tactical use of nuclear devices, because it erodes that bright line between what should be both unspeakable and unthinkable, and makes it both speakable and thinkable, and I think that's a tragic error. We are in a war on terror, and we can talk some other time about whether Iraq is the right battlefield of that war. We are in a war for our own liberties and civil liberties, and we can talk at another time about their erosion and about how hard it is to win them back. But weapons of mass destruction are a clear and present danger that take lives, that will take lives. And we are closer to the beginning of this war on terror than we are to its end. But it will end. And that's part of why I am hopeful. Reigns of terror end. Zealots burn themselves out after a while. And they take people with them. That's the tragic part. But they don't have a vision. They don't have a program. They don't offer a future. They eventually turn in on each other and devour their own. Terrorism ultimately doesn't work, whatever its morality or immorality, whatever the personal rage or affront, it doesn't work and it will burn itself out. I remain an optimist partially because I have to. Because in order to get out of bed in the morning and engage the world, I have to believe that what I do and what I choose and what I try makes some kind of difference, even if I can't see what that difference is. Even if that difference does not wash, that ripple does not wash onto a shore in front of my eyes or even in my lifetime. That is a necessary article of faith, to engage the world and to say yes to life. But it's not simply that. I believe, along with Anne Frank, and this is from experience, that most people are basically good. That most people whom I know would, in fact, feed the hungry and clothe the naked and plead for the widow and orphan. That most people would do justice, love mercy. Walk humbly is a little tougher. But do the real essential things with and for each other. In all of my travels around the world, in every community, in every society, in every religion, in every ethnicity, I find far more good than evil, far more kindness and hospitality and sense of our mutual connection and the rituals and the beliefs and even the crazy things that bring us together and can be used to unite us. I believe that what we do makes a difference. I believe that the kindness that we show a stranger makes a difference. The food that we collect doesn't feed everyone, but it feeds someone. And it makes a difference to them. and it makes a difference to the kids who pick it up and carry it up here every week because it reminds them that these adults have values that go beyond their family and beyond even this community. And in seeing our children do it, it reminds us also. And it's a positive feedback loop with real consequences. Human beings have some remarkable insights and stories. I heard a story on Wednesday night that Shimon Peres shared. It was a story that he heard from a black man in South Africa who happened to be a Muslim, and it's a rabbinic story. So how much better can life be to get a rabbinic story through a South African black Muslim delivered to me personally who'd never heard it in Pasadena? The circle of life is just too wonderful sometimes. And this story involves an old rabbi, there are always old rabbis in these stories, and two disciples. And the disciples ask the rabbi, when does night end and dawn begin? And the old rabbi, being an old rabbi, says, you tell me. So one disciple says, the night ends and the dawn begins when you are able to discern from 100 meters a fig tree from an olive tree. The other disciple says, no, that's crazy. Yeah, that's how disciples are. They miss the point and argue the metaphor. No, that's crazy. It's when you can tell a black goat from a white lamb at 100 meters. So, Rabbi, which of us is right? And the rabbi says, when you see a black woman and a white woman and call them sister, when you see a rich man and a poor man and call them both brother, that is when it is dawn. I believe that the dawn will break. I believe that hearts and bodies will break before we see that dawn, but we can help it come. We are not passive observers. We are bringers of the dawn and celebrators of the dawn.